Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only...
One and only? That's the only one I know. Hal Linden. Nice to meet you, Jason.
Are you kidding me? The pleasure's all mine. No, we're here to talk The Price, Arthur Miller's classic, now at Arena Stage. Everybody come check it out. Now, before we dive into the show, I want to ask you about... I hear that once upon a time you played in an army band down at Fort Belvoir. You were in the area?
Well, you've been checking your Google, huh?
That's what it's for.
That's what it's for. I actually, that was a turning point in my life.
Really?
Yeah. Up until that point, I was a musician. I was a trained classical clarinet player. If I had any discipline, I probably would have ended up in a major symphony. I was very good. I ended up kind of sliding over into jazz. I played with the big bands. And when I went in the Army, I was stationed indeed at Fort Belvoir in the band playing the clarinet. I had never set foot on a stage. I had no interest in the stage. I never even went to the theater. I came from New York. I never went to the theater. And it was in Fort Belvoir. I was always the band singer. I was always the personality kid out in front, you know. So when I was in Belvoir, I got involved with the soldier shows, singing, and at some point, you know, doing sketches and whatnot. And when I got out of service, it happened to coincide with the end of the big band era. The beginning...
Good timing.
Well, it was the beginning of rock and roll, which I never appreciated. And so...
Even after it took off, you never got into it. You pined for the big band days.
Well, it took off. It was in the primitive days of rock and roll when I got out of the Army. And yes, I indeed pined for the big band days. And so that's when I gave the theater a shot, and look what happened.
So a lot of our listeners are going to love that, and that no one knew that the great Hal Linden had never been on a stage until Fort Belvoir playing in the Army band. That's great. How did you? What was that next step then? So you see that big band's dying. You see rock and roll coming in. You say, oh, I kind of like being on the stage. What was your first acting class or role? How did you actually make that pivot?
I went to the only guy I knew who had ever been on the stage. I said, what do I do? And he said, well, you got to learn how to act. You got to learn how to sing. You got to learn how to dance. You got to learn it. So I started... studying everything. I used my GI Bill. I went to the American Theater Wing and did a few courses there, and started auditioning for summer stock. I got my first audition. I won it, or I got the job. And from there, and then for the next couple of years, I did both. I'd do a season of summer stock, and then I'd come home and play weddings and bar mitzvahs. And until I finally got a shot on Broadway, got my big break, if you will, and started a career.
That's so great. See, all of these roles that we've enjoyed over the years started with Fort Belvoir and then the GI Bill. There you go. There you go. That's it.
I am not making a political statement, but yes, yeah. The GI Bill.
Hey, it's history. It's fact at this point. Oh, that's so great. All right. Well, we're here to talk Arthur Miller's The Price at Arena Stage, your first time at Arena. Actually, DC's having a bit of an Arthur Miller moment now because Death of a Salesman's over at Ford's. The cast of that just came in studio a couple weeks ago. But I guess before we dive too far into, you know, the show, let's pretend some of our listeners maybe they don't know what it's about. Give them the basic premise of The Price.
The Price, the title is a metaphor for the price we pay for the decisions we make.
Sacrifices,
win them, lose them, you know, as he says in the show, sometimes the biggest decisions are the ones you don't even know you're making. Until the results start coming in, and you're stuck with them. But we all do make decisions and moves. And so, look at the one I did, you know. Yeah. I specifically decided to try the theater. That was a decision. I could have paid a big price.
Well, the price was right for you. But
the price was right. And basically, that's what the play is about. It does specifically deal with the price of furniture. The main character is trying to sell off his... father's, the legacy, as it were, all the old furniture from the from his father's house, which is going to be torn down. So, and I'm the dealer who comes in to give him the price. But it's basically about decisions, choices. Gotcha. Miller knows how to deal with those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty sure. So when he wrote Salesman, that was early in his career. I want to say it was probably in the 40s. And he pulled a lot of inspiration from his own father, who I think had lost a lot during the stock market crash, I think in New York's the garment industry. But this, I think, is 1968. This is decades later, and he sets it post-Depression, right? This is the backdrop of the story. How does what do you think from Miller's – I think I read somewhere that he based one of the characters on a childhood friend of his. Are you aware of this?
No. Nope.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me more about your character.
Well, when I we did the reading here, one of the board members, as I was walking out of the room, said, "Boy, you're just like my Uncle Louie." And I said to her, I had an Uncle Louie too. And I have a feeling Arthur Miller must have had an Uncle Louie, because that's the kind of character that I play, a Russian Jewish immigrant who has survived all his life. He says, I struggled in six different countries, almost got killed a couple of times, but he survived. I suspect Miller probably drew from his own family. The main problem is the two brothers who were not fighting over the furniture, but fighting over history, fighting over their...
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, their view of what happened. They've obviously been separated for about 16 years, I think. They were, the word is not separated. What word am I looking for?
Estranged.
And their view of why they've both been estranged is obviously different.
Right.
We all stand on the same mountain, but we look into different valleys. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So, that's Miller has a terrific sense of the ironic in that sense, how people see what happened in history.
Yeah.
It's what defines all of us when you come to think of it. I mean, this country is being torn apart by all kinds of different views, and they're all probably valid, but they all are kind of out of context.
Yeah. You have to put them in their own little silo.
They're all in their own little, exactly, their own little silo, and they don't see anybody else's. And this is the tragedy of this play is that is the inability to see what the other person's saying or hear what the other person's saying.
Absolutely. So we've talked a lot about sort of about the characters in the show and the themes, the setting. Take me into the actual text itself, the Miller's prose. What I'm sure you've grappled with it over the years, but him as a writer itself, when you've actually read his words, what makes him such a great writer?
Well, first of all, my character is an anomaly for Miller. I don't know that has he ever written a character in with an accent. I mean, he's a foreign character. He,
right.
You know, his traditional characters have been American types. He has the ability to be able to plumb an emotional moment and put it in a few words. I think that's the point. And they're interesting. They're not cliched words. They're fascinating words. The work that we did plumbing those depths was worth everything that we'll ever do. Just stopping at every word and saying, why did he use that word? Why does he? What? How do you feel about what he said? You know, and that kind of digging. I hope everybody who comes to see it enjoys it. But let me tell you something. I already got I already got the most out of it.
Yeah, we'll all get a little bit out of it, but you get the most. Take me just into, it's your first time at Arena Stage, too. General impressions of just the theater here in itself.
The theater? I'm finding American theater is getting more and more professional, grounded. American theater was always in a little, especially when I started it, that was a question. We called it the invalid.
The invalid.
Yes, we thought American theater was dying because, first of all, we were going to have our big, television was going to come in. Certainly nobody was going to ever go to the theater when you can see it at home. Well, theater has survived and survived splendidly. Especially with regional theaters like Arena, where the whole work is done. It's not. It used to be, pastiche, throw something together and send it out to the burbs. No, now it's the same, maybe even deeper work than I did in I did 20 original Broadway shows in my life. And if we didn't dig any deeper there, then we're digging here. And we didn't have the same. We had the same dedication to doing it as well as possible on Broadway as we did here.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. This year's big Broadway winner, the big Tony champ, started here at Arena Stage. Dear Evan Hansen, I'll never forget seeing it. You knew you were watching something special, but that's to your point. It's sort of flipped. So.
And you're going to see that more often. You're going to see that more often because it's easier to develop ideas in smaller areas. And find out if you got something. You find out pretty quick if you got something of value. And to develop it,
You mentioned your early years on Broadway. Take me into the Rothschilds, winning that Tony in 1971. First memories of the role itself, but then also sitting there on Tony night, getting your name called.
You're starting at the end.
Well, let's go back early on. Let's hear about the Broadway debut.
How about making a Broadway debut in the leading role of a musical opposite Judy Holliday?
Can you imagine?
Never had been on a Broadway stage, and that was my first step on a Broadway stage.
Now, that's a high bar.
How about that for a high bar? Pure luck.
Yeah.
Pure luck. I mean, pure luck in getting.
You were born yesterday, and she was inborn yesterday.
That's right.
I mean, that's basically what we're doing.
She was in Bells Are Ringing, and her leading man, the understudy, the standby to the leading man was leaving, and there was an opening. I happened to be going with a girl who was in the show.
Oh, really?
And I was up in summer stock, and she went to the stage manager. I didn't even have an agent. This is the beginning. And she went to the stage manager and says, I know somebody who'd be perfect for this. It was now going to be an understudy role, go into the chorus and understudy the part. And I drove all the way in from somewhere in Connecticut or something, Massachusetts, I don't remember, to audition for the stage manager, to get the audition for the casting director. I mean, that's how...
Right, that's where your mindset was.
Well, not my mindset. That was reality.
That's where you were in your career.
I couldn't get an audition. Yeah. There was no agent. Right. Nobody knew me. And I did that. I came back about 3-4 times auditioning for various people. Finally, I guess I fit. And they finally auditioned for Judy. Judy said... Okay. That was on a Saturday between shows. It was an interesting Saturday, too, because at the time I was a Ray Charles singer. Do you know what that was?
Yeah, of course.
I'm not talking about Ray Charles the entertainer. I'm talking about Ray Charles the musical director.
Well, then I have no. Inform me.
Well, if you go look into your archives on television shows, this happened to be the Perry Como show.
Okay.
And there were the Ray Charles singers. A chorus that sang behind Perry. And we were rehearsing that Saturday afternoon. He had a Saturday night show live. I did the rehearsal. We broke for dinner. I ran to the Schubert Theater, auditioned for Judy Holliday. She said okay. I went back to the theater, did the Perry Como show, told Ray I couldn't do next week because I was going to rehearsal for this new show, for the show. After that, I got in my car, drove out to Long Island, and played a bar mitzvah on the saxophone.
Oh, my God. That's an action-packed night.
and told that leader I couldn't do any more jobs for him because I was going to become the understudy. And I went into rehearsal on Monday with the stage manager and a book. He staged me and everything, showed me how to do it for 4 days. Saturday morning was understudy rehearsal. The first understudy rehearsal with other people where I actually got to do the scenes. And during the rehearsal, he said, keep going because you're on today.
Wow.
And I made my Broadway debut in the lead opposite Judy Holliday, never having rehearsed with her, there was one big number I did, which I never rehearsed because I never rehearsed with the chorus. I don't have to tell you. But that started it. I never played professionally as a musician again.
That's crazy to me. All right, well, before we go any further, I need to know what it was like on stage with Judy Holliday. You know, how special was that? You probably were nervous as anything, but at the same time, just thrilled to be out there.
And I will tell you the most amazing thing, I wasn't nervous at all. I was just so focused on what I had to do that there were no nerves. Judy Holliday was the most sharing actress I think I've ever worked with. I'll tell you one quick story. Mm-hmm. We had never done it before.
Right.
We'd never even rehearsed. Just in Time, the song Just in Time was done in one downstage, going from stage left to stage right, taking her in my arms and dancing with her and singing into her ear, which I did. I took her in my arms and I started singing, just in time, I found you just in time. And all of a sudden I felt her hand on my back, twisting me. Twisting. And I kept singing and I realized she was twisting me so that I was facing the audience.
So she's guiding
and
you.
And not singing into the wings. And we got, how do you not fall in love with somebody and that meant that her back was now to the audience.
But she knew it was your moment, and she wanted to give it to you.
Exactly. And let me tell you something, that's a very big lesson you have to learn in the theater. You always have to know what's important. Where is the audience supposed to be paying attention? And it's your job to make sure that's where they're looking. Not always at you, but at whatever is driving the play.
Wow.
Yeah. Big lesson, my first day on a Broadway stage.
And what selflessness by her, too. Wow, that's an amazing story. I love it. Okay, well, I mentioned the Rothschilds, but let's fill in the gap between your first one and that one. Any other highlights or favorite roles in between it? What, Anything Goes, Cole Porter?
Anything Goes was in there. That was off-Broadway. Yeah. That show I took a cut in pay from unemployment insurance to do.
Talk about selflessness. There you go.
Well, the opportunity, that's all. It was a terrific opportunity. Yeah. But basically, what you're describing is a decade as an understudy and a standby, the most frustrating decade in my life. But an interesting decade for me because that's when I got married. That's when I had 4 children, all in that time. So by the time I got to shows where I had any kind of a personal reputation where they would hire me, and especially with the Rothschilds, which was, 13 years after bells are ringing, 12 years, something like that. Yeah. So 12 years of really struggling in the vineyards.
But personal growth.
Personal milestones, and then to the Rothschilds, which was a fascinating moment in one's personal life and theatrical life. It was the first time a song was ever written for me personally.
Really?
That's an amazing thing. I didn't buy a team like Harnick and Bach, you know.
Come on, man.
They actually wrote two songs for me, but there was a whole score before I joined the show, but after we were in the show, one song was written in Detroit.
What was the song they wrote for you?
The song in Detroit was In My Own Lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah. My kind of signature song now.
Yeah.
And the second song was written in Philly. That was Coins. He tossed a coin. Mm-hmm. Really wonderful piece of material. And thank heaven it ended up in a... not only in a Tony, but the man who eventually wrote and produced Barney Miller,
yeah,
happened to see the Rothschilds. And that was 2.5-3 years later. And he remembered. And I never auditioned for Barney Miller.
He saw me,
and when he was putting the character together, I was the guy he had in mind.
I want that guy that sang Coins. That's
there
what he said.
He could have.
Oh,
so this is a strange business, I gotta tell you.
How one thing leads to another.
How one thing leads to another, and sometimes some great things lead to nothing.
True.
I knew too many magnificent performers who just never had the opportunity to shine publicly shine. They've done it privately with their, everybody knew they were great, but never. I was a very, very lucky human being.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned Barney Miller. I mean, that's what, when I post this piece and we say Hal Linden, everyone would say, you talked to Barney Miller? You know, that, I'm telling you, man. So beloved. I obviously caught it in reruns. You know, I wasn't around for the original,
of course,
original time. But come on, just as magical, just as magical. Do you fond memories of being on set like that the very first time? You have no idea this show is going to take off like it is. It's all kind of set back in the police precinct, back behind the scenes.
The first pilot was a failure.
Really?
Yes. There was a pilot. The first pilot was in March or something, or January. March, I think. And in August, they put it on the air as the ABC Comedy Theater. You know what that is? That's all the dead pilots. It was a dead pilot. It was not picked up.
Really?
The producer had such faith in it that he convinced them somehow to do another couple of episodes. And I remember he called me in New York. I got the call in New York. By this time, I had an agent, by the way.
Right.
Yes, and a manager.
Of course.
Yes. And I also had an offer for a Broadway musical.
What show?
It was a show called Dr. Jazz.
Okay.
Dr. Jazz. It was about it took place in New Orleans, about New Orleans jazz.
Okay.
But I didn't know it was not going to be a big smash.
Right.
Who, you know. And I didn't know what Barney Miller, they turned it down once. Why wouldn't they turn it down again? So what do you do? Do you take two episodes on television as opposed to maybe 3-4 years' work on Broadway? It was not that easy a decision. And it was made very cavalierly, if you really want to know. I waited till the last minute. Finally, I had to make a decision, and I said, oh, what the hell? We tried Broadway. Let's try television. And that was it.
Wow.
That was the decision. Right.
We're all glad that you did. Well, how did you... But you said it was a cavalier decision. Sounds like a pretty big roll of the dice on your part. But was there something in the pilot, even though that it failed, was there something... Did you see something in there that you said, you know, if we just keep at it a couple more episodes, that this thing could work?
No. No.
Total, just by chance.
I had no idea. Yeah. The truth... When I was offered Barney, I was offered two other pilots as well. That came right off the Tony in the Rothschilds, and all of a sudden I was in demand out there. I had to make a choice between three shows. Two of them were our shows, cop shows, I guess. Yeah, one was a cop show. I don't even remember the other one. But they were our shows, filmed shows. Barney Miller was a sitcom which was going to be done live in front of an audience, and I... said to myself, you know, I know how to work in front of an audience. Right. Maybe I should stick with the audience. Uh-huh. And that's the reason I chose Barney, not because of any other...
It's because you love being on stage in front of people.
Right, which turned out to be a total mistake. That is, I very quickly learned that the audience in television is not the 400 people sitting in the stands, but the camera over there.
The millions watching at home. Yeah.
Well, who eventually watch at home. Yes.
Wow.
And so I chose it for the wrong reason, if you really want to know.
But it worked out.
it worked out, exactly.
Yeah. That's so great. Why do you think it took off, though? We're talking about, you know, how you sort of fell into it by chance and a roll of the dice, but why do you think the formula of the show worked? Sort of the behind the scenes and the, what is it, Greenwich Village Precinct?
You said the formula of the show. Let me tell you something. It was not a new formula. There had been what they call gang comedies for decades. I go back to Phil Silvers and Sergeant Bilko. And,
right.
All kinds of gang comedies. And the year that Barney Miller went on, I think there were 7 gang comedies, and Barney was the only survivor. So it wasn't the formula, it wasn't the form, it was the execution. You had probably, I think it was possibly the best writing staff. The show lived for 8 seasons because it was probably one of the best written shows. There were no comedians in the original company. We were all just actors. And because it was written humor, it wasn't portrayed humor.
Right.
It was situational.
Right.
We used to take out punchlines because all you had to do was cut back to a guy's look, and the audience knew what the joke was.
It was the emphasis on the sit in the sitcom, not the
emphasis on the sit in the sit, exactly.
Right.
And the writing was probably, as far as I was concerned, you know, just superb, just the best ever. We did not ad lib. You didn't find us coming up with funny stuff and things like that because it was there. It turned into, as an experience, one of the best acting companies, repertory companies, yeah, that you could find. And even the people we arrested were repertory. Mm-hmm. There were people who did 6 or 7 Barney Millers as 6 or 7 different characters over the years because they were so good, and it became like a repertory company.
Yeah.
And as such, it was classic because of that.
Yeah. I want to know memories of the late Abe Vigoda, working with that guy. He'd done Godfather before, yeah, Barney Miller. Part 2 was 74, the year that Barney Miller started. So he was known in that vein, and then to come over on the comedy set.
He auditioned for a different part.
Really?
Yes. He went up because there was one of the characters, one of the detectives had an Italian name, and he and his agency sent him up because of his association with the Godfather, that he would. And when Danny took one look at him, and he said, "No, I have a different idea," and he created Fish. Wow. for Abe.
Yeah, yeah. What was it like working with him though? In those seasons?
Abe was, shall I use the word iconic? I guess. Abe was Abe, and everything was written specifically for that character, for that history, and for Abe. So Abe, no matter what happened, was Abe.
That's awesome.
Which turned out to be pretty great.
Yeah, I'd say. Before last Barney Miller question, do you have a favorite episode? You've probably been asked that billions of times with billions of different answers.
Yes,
but
I have been asked it a billion times.
What's one that still makes you like laugh to yourself?
Okay, the quintessential Barney Miller episode that I, if ever I have to pick one that somebody shows, I pick the hash brownies episode.
I think I've never seen that one.
Which was just amazing. Beautiful, beautiful episode. Although the one that I recall most was one that I directed. Later on, we Max Gale directed a few. I directed a few. Because, understand, we were really directing the acting company. By that time, all the cameramen knew exactly what to do, where to go, you know, and we knew how to set up so that you could shoot it. So it wasn't, you didn't need a real cinematographer to direct it. And there was one that I directed that just stands out in my mind. I don't even remember the name of it, but it featured Steve Landisberg and a woman who came into complain. I think she had her purse stolen, and the byplay between the two of them, I remember, was, you know, banal and didn't mean anything, and it was asking about the kids and what your husband did, but the underscoring of what had gone on between them before and what they regretted never doing you know, I thought maybe we could still, you know, that boiling under was just, it was just a joy to find. So I remember that episode very, very deeply.
That's awesome. So lots of roles between then and now, but why the price? Where does this role fit into your arc here?
Well, I'm finally old enough to play it, or almost old enough to play it. He is described in the play as 89 years old, so... it takes, of course, a lot of makeup to get that to that.
To get to yes, look at that, to yeah. Look, yes. Well, you can come back in a couple years and play it again when you actually hit
when
it.
I, right, there you go. I also remember when it was first on Broadway. I didn't see it, but it had a very fascinating history. If you got time, I'll tell you a very wonderful story.
I got plenty of time. I'll sit here as long as you want to sit here.
It's a wonderful story because it was the year before I did a musical on Broadway called... Ilya Darling, one of my major hits. And it was a musical version of Never on Sunday with Melina Mercouri and directed by Jules Dassin. It was quite a big thing. And I played the villain. And I understudied the male lead, who was a Greek movie star they had brought over from Greece. Because it took place, of course, in Greece. My understudy was an actor who had spent his whole life understudying people. I talked, you know, good actors who just keep going and never shine. And he was now in his late 60s, and he was playing the bartender in the taverna. He had three lines, you know, the whole show. And he understudied me. And we were dressing roommates, so we kind of knew each other. And he had a simple life. He lived in a hotel on Broadway, which was in those days was pretty seedy, very seedy. He lived in one room, and he spent his afternoons in a coffee shop in the back table with his cronies, you know, telling lies.
Yeah.
And he got, when our show closed, he got the understudy to this part in the original company of The Price.
And what is this, like 1968?
68. Okay. And 3 days before opening, the man who was supposed to play the part, who was Davy Burns, a major Broadway star, I think it was a heart attack, got a heart attack, was, you know, got... And all of a sudden...
Passed away? Or,
No, he didn't. He eventually, by the way, Davy Burns did eventually die on stage in, I think, his next show.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, look it up, you'll see it. But he had the wisdom to go behind a couch and die.
Wow.
Yes.
So
anyway,
could go on. Bring it back to the furniture.
There you go.
But anyway, the other guy got the part.
His name was Harold Gary. You'll look him up. Mm-hmm. He's the original because he opened the show on Broadway. Now, he was in his late 60s, I think, by this time. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the movies he did. I remember he was in The French Connection. You know, he got a part in another movie. And how did it change his life? He moved to a bigger room in the same hotel.
I was going to ask you, did he stay in that little apartment?
and now he was sitting in the front table at the coffee shop.
Telling the same
lies,
bigger lies.
The difference of his stature. Right. He now walked tall. I guess all his life he had just plugged away, waiting for something to happen, and all of a sudden, at late in life, it happened. And he only lived, I think, maybe 5 or 7 years after that. But he lived as a thespian, you know.
He had finally made it as a thespian.
Had that break where you had the opportunity to show what you could do. Right. So many actors never get that shot. Yeah. Tough.
Who are some of the younger ones here that are finally getting their shot alongside you?
Here?
In this show.
Well, wait, you know, give me...
They're showing your cast a little bit here.
Mahboud, I can't pronounce his second name. Ebrahimzadeh. Ebrahimzadeh.
Yeah.
He's got the load in this show. He's on stage the entire show. The show is about his character,
right.
Because his is the character that made the decisions or didn't make the decisions that define his life. Raphael, I can't pronounce his name either. Raphael and Pearl. Pearl's son plays Victor's wife, and Raphael. As I say, these are not simple roles. They ride along on the words, but there's an awful lot of weight and history and pain behind every phrase. And I get the fun role, quite honestly, because I'm not a part of the family. I'm
right.
an outside character.
Yeah.
Yeah, so mine is not easy, but relatively compared to the work that they had to do to really dig into those. I mean, everyone comes with this 16-year history.
Yeah.
You got to relive 16 years in order to go on the stage. That's what they actually ended up doing, basically.
Wow.
Creating those 16 years so that they could live today.
That's great.
Yeah.
I hear after the price, you're also going to get a major award during the opening night of the Pajama Game. It is called the American Artist Award. I guess sort of a lifetime achievement sort of a deal. How big of an honor is that? Can you believe we're at this point now? We're getting the lifetimers?
Lifetime Achievement Award, my God. Body of work, you know. One doesn't think of his... career as a body of work, honestly, just a bunch of jobs that went back to back, you know. And it's, you know, it's terrific. It's a great honor, especially from an organization as prestigious as the Arena Stage. So I will be as humble as I can. I got to study a little humility between now and then, all right?
Yeah, okay. No, it's coming across.
Okay.
I think the microphone picks it up.
Okay.
Hal Linden, thanks so much. This was an absolute honor to talk. I could sit here and talk all day, so thank you so much.
A pleasure.